All right. There's a place that I like to go to visit. It's not too far from here. And I try to go there several times a year. It's a place that my friend Mark showed me years ago. It's called Ferry Bluff. And it's just a few miles west of Sauk City. You drive in an inconspicuous little road that comes in from the side, and there's a little parking lot right near where a little stream comes into the Wisconsin River. And you walk along the river for about an eighth of a mile, and then there's a path that leads up to the bluff, to the top of the bluff. It's a pretty steep climb, and at the top, it's bare limestone. It hangs out directly over the river, and it is a beautiful vantage point. You can see for miles in any direction. You can see south all the way, south or west, all the way to Blue Mound, and looking the other direction, you can see beyond Sauk City. It was a sacred place to the Indians. You know that because planted off to the side is cactus. And the cactus no doubt comes from Mexico City. Because where Mexico City is now was a lake, a volcanic lake with an island in the middle that had three things on it: snakes, eagles, and cactus. And when the young Native Americans went on their vision quest as part of their coming into manhood, they would travel and they would find sacred spots, and then they would plant the cactus in those spots. This is at least what a Native American told me. And so when you see cactus somewhere, you know that you're at a holy place or a special place in nature. Now for me, the place has been very important because I have learned some things about perspective. Sometimes when it's a partially cloudy day and there's little wind, you can look and see the sky reflected in the water. In fact, I even have a game that I sometimes play with people. If there are a lot of small clouds, you look on the surface of the river and you see a cloud on the surface of the river, and then you try to see which one it is in the air. And sometimes it's tricky because the reflection, the angle of incidence is such a broad angle that sometimes you don't know what a cloud looks like when you're seeing its reflection. Another perspective that I gain in that place is looking straight down into the water. If you look straight down from the top, all of the turbulence is, you can see it all. You can see the sand being turned up by the moving water. But it seems of no consequence when you're looking down from the top, even though you know better with your mind. It's like you're above it all. It's like a contemplative state. And you're above all of that. From the bottom, it's a very different story. In order to see that place from the bottom, you'd have to stabilize a canoe, either that or you'd have to wade in the water, and you'd have to look straight up. And the outcropping and the cliff, on which it is atop, are formidable. They're right in your face. So you see a much different kind of image. Now, you get the sense of peace at the top, but it's a quiet peace. And it's peaceful simply because there's no excitement at hand. So it may be arduous to climb up the bluff, but the whole experience from above and below is worth it all. Now, if you had a global positioner with you, and you looked at this from the satellite, in terms of longitude and latitude, it would be identical. Whether you saw it from the top or whether you saw it from the bottom, it would have the same longitude and latitude because it's a vertical drop-off. The only difference that there would be the interval of altitude. And the interval of altitude is what we're going to be talking about in these talks. These talks, because they're designed to be an hour long or less, will probably be shallow and superficial. What we're going to talk about is an identical quality experienced over an interval. And from identical quality to identical quality, it is called an octave. Now, octaves and octavation play a large part in the cosmos because the cosmos is basically tonal and musical. Correlatively, the principle of analogy plays a large part in the cosmos. In fact, it is what is behind the principle of octavation. From the most universal state of pure spirit to the most particulate state of matter, unity is maintained. And the unity is maintained along the spirit-matter pole by what is called the principle of analogy. And the principle of analogy is sometimes called the Hermetic axiom. As above, so below, what has gone before in heaven will follow after on earth. Know this and rejoice. So, it's much deeper than that in the cosmos, because each succeeding state of existence has its own purpose. It has its own quality. Just like each note in an octave has its own quality. So there is a kind of a linear logic, which is why it's called the spirit-matter pole, in relating different realms to each other. For example, in our solar creation, things begin with the will to be. The will to be that is filled with love. And that precipitates within itself love and light and creative activity. This love and light in turn produces a world of thought and reason. First abstract and then concrete. And the world of thought precipitates from within its being the world of desire, feeling, emotion, and motivation. And within the desire world is precipitated a realm of energy and of vitality, which we call the etheric subdivision of the physical world. And this in turn precipitates the finalizing physical world. So we find ourselves, our being, which is really a product of this creation, we find this same psychological delineation. If we have an impulse of will, and that produces an urge to loving creativity in ourselves, and out of that an idea is born, an immaculately conceived idea, And out of that one idea, it spawns many, many possible thoughts. And some of those thoughts, we take the meaning of the idea and we use them to spur motivation. And then that motivation produces action, and the action produces a residual effect as a physical experience. This is something that we all experience sometimes thousands of times a day. In the same way that this process is carried outward from deep within the spirit into all the way out into the physical world, proceeding in a reverse direction in a cycle of life, when we have an impactual experience in the outer physical world, and even light striking our eyes is an impact through the senses that is carried inward through the vital ethers, and we have an emotional impression of this experience. And that emotional impression causes us to think about the experience we've just had, and the thought is carried back to the parent principle or to the idea in the transcendent realm. And you might say, in the whole cycle, we try to accomplish something, and when it is accomplished, we digest the experience so that the fruits of all the experience are built into our creative consciousness, and we are brighter in our consciousness at the end of the cycle than we were at the beginning. Of course, this always prompts a new creative urge. So this is our regular cycle of extroversion and introversion. The thing to note about it is that every stage of it has a specific function, and it has a specific purpose in moving the cycle along and in fulfilling the entire experience. Each of these worlds, world of thought or the world of emotion, each of these worlds has its own laws. But because of the unity, they are analogously parallel to each other, because it's always one spirit that is functioning through the different states of manifestation. Now, according to the Rosicrucian philosophy, we're going to be a little arbitrary here for a few minutes. In the succeeding talks, we're slowly going to get a little more and more deep about it. According to the Rosicrucian philosophy, our whole creative manifestation in which we are participating takes place in seven worlds. And all seven worlds are manifest within seven grand cosmic planes. We are manifestations of the seventh cosmic planes. Now, each of these seven worlds has seven subdivisions within it. Now, there are reasons, necessary reasons, why all of these sevens. It's not just superstition, but it is manifestly and mathematically necessary that there be seven. But we really can't go into that now, because that's way beyond the scope of what we're doing. Mystics claim that all of these sevens, the seven worlds within the seventh cosmic plane, the seven subdivisions of the seven worlds, all of them are undertones. They are undertones from the one original cosmic word. The cosmic word, which was itself a sound or a tone, and which had within it nothing but meaning, nothing but spiritual meaning. So, what this is we're carrying out a work within a cosmos that is activated. Higher the higher end of each interval, whether it is a subdivision of a world or whether it is a world within the cosmic plane, it is all a principle of octavation. With all of these combinations, and there are many more than this simple skeletal presentation, with all of these variations, we have an almost infinite variety of conditions through which we experience. And each of these experiences brings out a different facet of our spiritual being, because the spirit is unlimited in its potential to bring out manifest glories, and we are fortunate enough to take part in such a process that brings it out with a splendor that would awe almost any artist. So, the world that we live in, because of all of this variegated octavation, is always different. It is always new. It is always fresh. And in it, we are whole. We can appreciate all of it because we are self-conscious beings sharing that one unity that is spread out through the different states of existence. So in these talks, what we're going to do is we're going to look at octave planets in astrology. We're going to look at higher octaves and lower octaves, and we're going to do a little bit of looking at horoscopes. But what we're going to do is going to be very fast and extremely superficial, and it's not really judicial astrology, which means you sit down and ponder something for a long time until it dawns on you what is taking place. But in all of this, it's just to give a few little ideas, maybe not always the most important ideas in these horoscopes. Now, these talks are designed to parallel the five evening talks. The five evening talks are about coevolution, our relationship to beings that are higher than us and our relationship to beings that are lower than us, that share this whole creative process that we are actively working in. But these talks sort of vaguely parallel it. Now, beside looking at horoscopes, each day we're going to go a little bit more deeply into the principle of octavation, because it's a very controversial thing in astrology, and there are many astrologers that teach an octavation that is different here, but it's unfortunate because those people never understood the mysteries and they have no idea even of other worlds, and they are basically materialistic astrologers. And we're going to see why this controversy exists as it exists and a simple way that we can see through it. Now, we're just about ready to look at horoscopes, but it'll take us another 15 minutes to get there. I'm sorry, that's just the way I am. But we want to review a little bit what an octave is. An octave is a quality that is the same thing that is manifested on a higher level or on a lower level. Now, that fairy bluff that we began talking about is really not an octave. It is the same thing because it has the same longitude and latitude, whether you're looking at it from the top or whether you're looking at it from the bottom. But it is not an octave because it is all just simply one thing. Now, for a second, I'm going to is an octave. It is the same thing on two different levels of pitch. This is not an octave, even though the notes are right next to each other. So you get the idea that you instinctively or you intuitively know within yourself that something is an octave because it rings through and you can see that it is the same quality. And this is really important. Now, in the physics of sound or music, you understand that there is a mathematical relationship between wavelength and frequency. Now, in character, it is not so certain. And unless you are intuitively focused on it and you can have a clear intuition, the octave relationship is not always easy to see. This is most likely due to the fact that we are a very miscellaneous composition. We have all sorts of things in ourselves, and most of us haven't taken a lot of time to turn inward and to understand ourselves and to know ourselves really clearly. It takes a long time and a lot of effort and a lot of patience to see what goes on in us. For example, some people don't even know that many of their thoughts are not their own thoughts, but they are thoughts that have been projected to them by other people, and it seems like they're their own because it comes from within. And there are a lot of people that take advantage of this kind of thing. Now, the people that are capable of hearing the music of the spheres, because when we're talking about octavation in the cosmos, in the inner cosmos, it is something that can be apperceived by us in our inner states. If we develop our sensitivity, if we develop our awareness and attune ourselves to the cosmos, we find out that we have a musical scale right within our own being. Not only between the different facets of our being, but right within the physical body. Each of the organs has its own tonal relationship to each of the other organs, and they're all attuned to one keynote, so that there are octaves right within our basic nature. So now, for a few minutes, let's be arbitrary. Tomorrow we will go into deeper explanations. In being arbitrary, we will follow what is taught by mysticism, by the mystery schools, that Venus and Uranus are octaves of each other. Now, if they are octaves, they carry something in common. And the thing that they carry in common is love. That's one of the things that they have. Venus is obviously the planet of personal love, of amores. It is the love of beauty. It is the love of sociability. It is the love of rich things. Not everyone is capable of responding to the full of the Iranian love. The Iranian love is altruistic love. For many people, the idea of altruism is an intellectual concept. They have not had the taste of honey. They have not felt what altruistic love is like. Even one tiny indirect experience of the Christ working from life spirit, which is the homeland of Uranus, just one little bit of that, and you understand the Iranian type of love. There is one part of Iranian love that most people have experienced, and that is friendship. Everything that Uranus does is unconditional. even to its downfall in the material sense. And the love of friendship is unconditional. For the sake of friendship, we would do almost anything. In fact, we would do anything. And that is because there is no condition between friends. There is no legal relationship as there is in a marriage. There is no blood relationship as there is with brothers and sisters. You're friends because you love each other and you want to be friends. And when there is no condition like that, a person is free to love. There's nothing to restrain it. Uranus does not like restraint in any way. So, unconditionally, Uranus is like that. Now, if you look for cultural verification, this might sound a little strange. There is mythological evidence for the Venus-Uranus octave relationship. The mystery schools, the Rosicrucian mystery school included, teach that myths are the source of very, very deep spiritual wisdom that has many sides of meaning to it, and through it we can come to understand things that we wouldn't understand in a simple, direct, material way. Now, in Greek mythology, there are two myths about the origin of Venus. We're going to look at the most common of those myths, and it goes back to the castration of Uranus by his son Cronos. In this creation story, Gaia, Mother Earth, gave birth to the Titans. And some of the Titans didn't turn out so well. And they didn't turn out so well because the first of the Titans was Uranus. And Uranus had an incestual union with his mother. And that degraded her dignity. But out of that incestual relationship, all of the other Titans were born. And so she persuaded them that if they wanted to have their legitimacy by maintaining or preserving her dignity, that they had to castrate or to neuter Uranus. This is something that's very common. Uranus is associated even in biblical stories, because Reuben, the son I'm going through a mental block of myself here. The children of Jacob, Reuben defiled his mother's bed, meaning to say that there was an incestuous relationship. We find in biblical mythology the same thing that we find in Greek mythology. But at any rate, what happened is all of the Titans got together and they sneaked up on Uranus when he was sleeping. Of course, this is all story. And they pounced on him and they held him down. And Cronos, which we know as Saturn, took his testicles in his left hand, and he had, and from then on, that was the left hand was the hand of infamy. And with his right hand, he used a flint sickle and he cut off the testes. And where the drops of blood fell, when he cut off the testes, the Erinnes sprung up. And the Erinnes were elemental beings that avenged any kind of sin, especially if it was some kind of fratricide or homicide or parricide or something like that. They were the avenging forces. And also that ash nymphs sprung up from the blood. They were the ones that took and nurtured Zeus when he was born and hidden from his father. Cronus let the testicles fall, and they fell into the sea. And when they fell into the sea, The dynamic creative power in the testicles caused the sea to churn, and the sea churned up a tremendous foam, and out of the foam, Venus or Aphrodite was born. And she went to the island of Cytherea, which was sacred to her, and that was her beginning. There's a lovely painting of her by Sandro Botticelli, in which she is on a half shell and coming floating in from the ocean. And she has a really innocent look on her face, unlike the look that he had in his other Venus painting, where he does Mars and Venus together. There she's got the cat that swallowed the canary look on her face. But at any rate, many people would not consider this evidence as the relationship between Venus and Uranus being an octave relationship, but I just thought I would put that out there so that you can see that there is that there is some foundation in myth. Frankly, I have to admit personally that in my life and in my study, I get much more out of mythology and out of the stories in many different levels of depth than I do out of just plain science. I wouldn't say that there's no place for science, but I get much more out of the stories. In fact, the scientists often have to go to the stories in order to find ways to explain what they have discovered. All right, now we're going to begin looking at horoscopes. And today we're going to look at the conjunction of Venus and Uranus and the sextile of Venus and Uranus. And tomorrow we will look at the square, the trine, and the opposition, which means we're really going to be flying through this. So what this is going, we'll have to talk a little bit about the conjunction. The conjunction is like being at Ferry Bluff, because two perspectives in terms of longitude and latitude are at one point. And the conjunction brings things to a point. It unifies them. And what happens is that the differential character of each of the planets that is brought into a conjunction is fused with the other. But in that fusion, they maintain most of their character, but they lose something. The best example that I can think of comes from science. It is an alloy. If you take two metals and put them together, the resulting metal has characteristics of both of the metals that went into it, but it has some other characteristics that weren't there. So that's what the conjunction is like. It is a fusing of two different things together. And what we want to do now is we want to look at horoscopes that have the conjunction of Uranus and of Venus and see what that fusion results in. No, what is this here? Oh,
both here?
Yeah, both of them. We're not looking at William Blake, but we have better things to look at than William Blake. This is the horoscope of Elizabeth Taylor. I like going back to horoscopes again and again and again, because you understand them in different ways and you bring different things out. She has Libra rising, so it wasn't surprising that she was one of the most beautiful women in the world when she was in her prime. I saw her with Montgomery Clift in a movie called Rain Tree County when she was in her young 20s. And she was astonishingly beautiful. You almost didn't see the movie because of looking at her beauty. It was so much. It was just unbelievable. When we look, we're trying to look at the hybrid quality of Venus and Uranus, which are conjoined. In pure Uranian love, there is something beyond anything earthly. It's so otherworldly, it's unbelievable. If you ask somebody to describe why their friend is their friend, everything you say cheapens the experience, because friendship is so otherworldly. You know, he's my friend. That's all you can say, and that's really quite enough. The thing that we're looking for here is when you have personal love united completely with transcendent love, the quality is romance. In pure Uranian love, it is otherworldly. In pure Venusian love, it's down to earth, but it's more of like a pleasurable relationship. The Venusian love wants tokens. It wants affections, or in Elizabeth Taylor's case, diamonds. And the Uranian love can thrive without anything except the love itself. And so when you put them together, you produce high romance with screaming violins and divine intimations and things like that. This is, I find, in looking at many horoscopes, I find this is the romantic element of Venus and Uranus is much stronger in the horoscopes of women. In this horoscope, the conjunction is in Aries, which describes what we saw in her life very clearly. Now, one of the things that Aries relates to that is common to Uranus is newness. But it's a different kind of newness. Aries likes the shiny new car, or this new car smell when you get inside of it. And after it's a week old, the Aries would want another new car. It's that sort of thing. Have it for a while and then it's off. Uranus, novelty or newness, is one of perpetual discovery of something that it's new all over again. It is very much like little children when they meet their friends, you know, like it's they just discovering them all over again. You can see it in their eyes and in their expressions. It's all beautiful. It's all new. So we see that this is somebody that likes falling in love. And each new falling in love has the same quality about it, and so that it's like a rediscovery of the cosmos. It's like a verification that every time that you fall in love, that there is a God somewhere. It's that kind of a thing. Now, the fixed sign planets in this horoscope are not really very strong. Saturn is not very strong. The moon is not very strong. Not many aspects at all. Is this clear enough? Let's see.
There.
There. So things change. When the fixed sign planets are weak, things change very rapidly. And when they change, she's off to having a new lover. She had, you know, 8 marriages and 7 husbands. That's quite a bit. And if she could have lived longer, she probably would have had another. And there's another beautiful thing in this. Venus and Uranus are both in a strong trine to Jupiter. So it's a very positive feeling. So there's not only ardor of love that you would get from the Aries part of it, but there is an element of optimism, the eternal optimist. You know, like this is not somebody who's going to get depressed. She's going to say, maybe this time it will work. Maybe this will be the good one, you know. And because there are so many planets in the 5th and 7th, and because there's a mutual deposition between Mars and Uranus, courtship is very important. When everything is clear and positive, and there's strong relationship between the fifth and seventh houses, there is that quality then of immediate relationship turning into partnership. This is the thing that I learned working with a lot of horoscopes. If people are having difficulty in a relationship, you ask them to point out in the horoscope where the problem is. And most usually the woman will point to the seventh house, and the men, if they know anything about astrology at all, will be pointing toward the fifth house. And they each have a different idea of what the relationship is all about. All right. These are supposed to last an hour, so we better move along. Well, we have having eye candy for the males, we have to have eye candy for the females. this is somebody 5 years younger, and somebody that has the sun in the seventh house, but that you would think that there would be many marriages, but Warren Beatty has only had one marriage. This is a male horoscope, and the two most male masculine planets are in fire signs. The masculine planets are the Sun and Mars, and they are in fire signs, and they are trying to each other. So this is somebody that can play the man. However, there's the Venus-Uranus conjunction, and it is in Earth, and that is a very different kind of thing. Now, counterparts are ruled by the seventh, and they are important to him. But he takes those parts of the relationship in a very masculine way. I am sure that he counted. I am sure that he kept score, because he had for lovers some of the most beautiful women in the world, some of the most desirable women in the world. I bet you somewhere he was keeping score, because it's, you know, the Aries type of thing, likes conquest. He was handsome, and he had all of that virility, like Valentino and Brando and people like that have. And even though the sun has only one aspect, the trine to Mars, it is a very masculine sort of way that he has about him. But it was so masculine in its charisma that even when lovers knew it wouldn't last with him, they still went and fell in love with him. And I read an article once where they interviewed women who had affairs with him. And they said that unlike any other person in the world, when he was romancing you, you were the only thing in his focus. The sun is in the west. The east, where the ascendant is for the personal. This is my way. But when you have the sun in the west, he discovered himself and knew himself in the other. And so he put himself very, very intensely into his partners. What we're really interested in is the Venus and Uranus, which are in an Earth sign. They're in Taurus, and that is the fall of Uranus. Uranus has all of its major stations, exaltation, fall, detriment, and rulership in fixed signs. I don't think we have time to go into that, so we'll just go beyond it. This is its fall. And the fall, the special weakness that comes out is like if Uranus is electricity, this is the electricity being grounded. Grounded almost like lightning that etches like the Ten Commandments or something like that. We can see that because of the earthy nature, this is not a heavily altruistic kind of person. If the only way it can get to be heavenly is if you believe in heaven on earth, which is just what this kind of consciousness does. Uranus rules immediacy. It is the kind of intuition that comes through with no thought. It's just there. It's like a discovery. So this is like falling in love and again renewing it. In this case, Venus is strong because Venus is in her own rulership. And it is fortified by three other planets. And in that relationship, the love was attractive. It wasn't just pure virility. It's sort of like the Aries part radiates outward, and around the rays a field forms, and that field is the attractivity that he has. Now, this brings up a really interesting thing. This has helped to cure me of an astrological disbelief I had. It's very clear that the seventh house is partnership, and that the fifth house is play and it's courtship. A lot of astrologers believe that since it's related to Scorpio, that the eighth house represents sexual relations and your nature towards sexual relations. I didn't always believe that, but after studying this chart as an opener and others after it, it's very clear that this would be very sudden romantic sexual relations, but very heavy on the physical part of it. So we can say that this is a kind of blissful experience for him. Now let's look at somebody very, very different. This is Emma Goldman. Everybody knows who Emma Goldman is. Now, we said earlier that the octaves represent one thing on two different levels. Now we see another side of it. And that is not only love, but feeling is on two different levels. Uranus is a planet of feeling. Yes, it does get involved with technical things, but when it does it by feeling. I spent my whole life working with electronics engineers, and earlier in my career studying astrology, I worked in a garage. And the Iranian mechanics and the electronics engineers, when they solve problems, they solve them by feel. I have actually even seen technicians run their hand over a diagram to feel the hot spots, to pick out the bugs. And so what we're talking about here is feeling. This is very clearly a planet that is strong in feeling. Water sign rising, Scorpio, which is intense feeling, and the most feelingful sign of the zodiac is Cancer. It feels out everything. It's like insects with the antennae out there that are super sensitive. Now, this is a capable woman. This is somebody who can get things done. And she did get things done. But she was an outright revolutionary and she was an anarchist. And so most of the things that she got done were things like riots. She was banned from, I think, every state in the Union and a few countries that she couldn't even go to. And when she went to Russia, they were too milquetoast for her because she wanted something more intense than that. Now, what we're dealing with here is a feeling toward destruction. Scorpio is rising, and its two rulers, Mars and Pluto, are in almost exact trine. Just 30 minutes away. That's a really strong trine. And if that isn't enough, you add Jupiter into the trine, And then you bring in the sextiles of Venus and Uranus. This is why this is a person who is capable of carrying things out. Pluto stays with it until it gets carried out. Mars carries out the actions of the others. And Jupiter and Uranus are highly speculative, and they bring out the different sides of the issue. A thing we want to note in this is that this is a very unmental chart. Mercury is retrograde, indicating often a weakness of mind. And it is only has one aspect, and that is to the sun. It's a moderate or a mediocre strength aspect, and it gets overpowered by the emotional feelings of the sign Cancer. None of the sextiles, including the Jupiter moon sextile, is mental. None of the trines is mental. If we want to look, then we have to look for feeling. Venus and Uranus are also in Cancer, but they're in the ninth house. So she's an idealist. She is an aspirant to utopianism. She feels it. However, when she is an idealist, she is a fantastic idealist. Because Venus and Uranus, especially Venus, is square to Neptune, and that is a strong sign of fantasy. So